final investigator I met with was Dr. Roman Perez Soler, and to begin the conversation, he reviewed the management of locally advanced non-small cell.
I guess everybody agrees that you should try to give concomitant chemotherapy and radiotherapy to patients that you think can tolerate it. The studies normally are done with the best patients, those who have lost less than 5% of weight, those that have good performance status. And in those patients, we know we can cure maybe 20% of them. So it's a situation where we tell the patients, I'm going for cure, therefore I'm going to give you a significant amount of therapy and you are going to have some toxic side effects. So I guess there are two basic regimens, which is carboplatin weekly with radiotherapy, which really never has been tested in a very solid way, but has become popular. And the main problem there is significant esophagitis. And many of these patients will lose a lot of weight during the therapy, require a G-tube, etc., etc. So if people are very old with comorbidities or they are fragile to start with, one is concerned about doing that. And the other is to give the old regimen of platinum VP16 plus radiation, which is, I think, better tolerated. And once we finish the 6, 7, 8 weeks of radiation plus chemotherapy, most of the patients have significant side effects. So to give more therapy after that, as you know, the SWOG group did Taxotere after that. And initially in a phase 2 single-arm study, they had very good results. And when they did a randomized study of Taxotere versus, I think it was observation, it was clear that if you add more therapy to these patients, you don't necessarily benefit them. So that's more or less where we are. So if you can, you would like to be able to offer chemo radiotherapy because is one of those situations for the thoracic oncologies where you can cure, actually.
One of the things I always wondered about is the issue of, you know, we give adjuvant systemic therapy with the idea of micrometastasis, and, you know, these people obviously have a huge risk of developing progressive disease, yet the total duration of chemo isn't kind of what you see in the adjuvant setting. Does that concern you at all?
Well, ideally, I think everybody would like to give a couple of more cycles of chemo, or three after the radiation, because during radiation you give approximately a 6-week period, you give two. So ideally, you'd like to give two more, particularly those who have a good response. But the bottom line is that it is true that these individuals, after having received the chemo radiotherapy, are not necessarily tolerating chemo well. So you are dealing with patients that are in bad shape to start with as a result of the very intensive therapy. But I agree with you. I think intuitively, we all believe in the fourth cycle of chemo as the best number of courses to maximize benefit for the patient. So two cycles is probably too little.
In other tumors, you see a lot of people thinking about induction chemo prior to chemo radiation therapy. What about that non-small cell?
It's being tested, and it's not being shown to be better than chemo radiotherapy just straight there, you know? It's probably not detrimental either, but it's not being shown to be better than chemo radiotherapy.
What about the patient who has an EGFR mutation? They're a non-smoker, so they get tested. They have locally advanced disease.
I think that's the interesting problem of today, because we know that if you start with an EGFR TKI, you have 80% response rate. We also know that these tumors are responsive to chemotherapy. We don't know really how to integrate the EGFR TKIs with other agents. And all the evidence with chemotherapy has been that we have not learned how to put them together. So do we know how to put an EGFR TKI with radiotherapy? Well, we don't know that. That's the reality. We know that the antibody, anti-EGFR, cetuximab, is synergistic with radiation in head and neck carcinoma, which is a similar disease. But with EGFR TKIs, now we have learned that we cannot extrapolate what is true for antibodies to EGFR TKIs. So what we have seen, the experience in more advanced patients with EGFR mutations, is that the EGFR TKI alone is as good as the EGFR TKI with chemo. And there is a potential for antagonism in some tumors too. So we don't know then how to really combine radiotherapy with EGFR TKIs. And I think that's a key question because that will be very important for these patients. So at this point, I think The prudent thing to do is to say we don't know how to combine an EGFR TKI with anything else concomitantly. But if somebody is an EGFR mutated, I know I have to give this person an EGFR TKI as part of the frontline strategy. And I think what most people will do, and what I have done, is to consider chemoradiotherapy followed by a maintenance, if you want, of the EGFR TKI. We could also do what you were talking about, an induction, then chemoradiotherapy, and continue with the other. But we don't know.
Induction with chemo or TKI?
No, with TKI.
Interesting.
Which would give you a 67% response rate.
Maybe decrease the radiation.
Right, might reduce radiation, and you go with chemoradiotherapy, and then you continue.
Have you ever done that?
I think I've done it once or twice. But, you know, we're doing these things based on intuitive and obviously the best intention to help patients. But we really don't know what are we doing. And we have to be aware also that not everything we do that seems to be a great idea is a great idea. So we've seen that actually the SWOG group did gefitinib, IRESA, in these patients, chemoradiotherapy, and then they did IRESA versus placebo. And the IRESA was worse. So is that bad luck? Or what is that? And now we saw also at ASCO in the Canadian study of adjuvant therapy with gefitinib, that it was actually no advantage, but actually was a little worse. And in the mutated patients, it was the worst. So something extremely disturbing, because you don't know even to believe this data. And sometimes when we deal still with EGFR mutated tumors, many times I think, are the technologies they are using to do all these analyses correct or the right ones? I always think there may be a technical aspect to this.
To the assay?
To the assay.
Huh.
Because some of the data is really shocking. Particularly in that study, the Canadian study, adjuvant gefitinib is worse in mutated tumors. So maybe there's a biological explanation that we cannot at this point figure out, but that's strange. And we also know from the Canadian group that when they did the analysis of EGFR mutations in BR21 years ago, the results were very also, I would say, difficult to interpret. So it raises the question whether we are really mastering technically all these, and whether all these patients in these studies actually have enough tissue to do a very nice and clean analysis of that. So, but in any case, so in the mutated patient that is locally advanced, what I will do one way or the other is integrate the EGFR TKI as part of the regimen, but chemoradiotherapy will be the key. I may give starting with erlotinib to see if I can shrink that tumor. And I will continue with erlotinib after that. To me, it makes biological sense based on the results that now have been confirmed with so many studies that the response rate is so high in the stage 4 patients that we all have confirmed, because we all have treated many, many patients with this, you know. So, but still we have to be careful. It seems that there are biological aspects to all this that we don't understand very well and that can play against us. So intuitive thinking, I am a big defender of that, but the fact that in some of these studies you see these very surprising results in the groups that receive the EGFR TKI, that is exactly the opposite, counterintuitive to what you would think would be, so makes me think that maybe there is some biological complexity that still we have not been able to figure out.
Anything new in terms of the skin rash with EGFR TKIs, both as predictors of response, but also in terms of management? I know you've looked into different kinds of creams and things. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I think at the time of introduction of these drugs in the clinic and when they were approved, it became clear to the oncology they were facing something new, and they were not really very prepared to now think as a dermatologist. So there was a lot of interest at that time to figure out what would be the best way to deal with this. I think we've seen less and less of a concern with the rash in general in terms of management, because I think people are trying different things. And we have seen several trials that, for example, oral tetracyclines seem to be able to at least reduce the incidence of the severe rashes without probably affecting the outcome. And then there are a certain number of remedies that you can try. And we all have taken the approach that not all tumors respond the same way. Not all skins will respond the same way. So people now have a menu of things to do, and they try them, and sometimes it works in some patients, sometimes it doesn't. But at the end of the day, if nothing works and still you have a patient with a very bad rash, symptomatic, I think we also have learned to think the following way, is that reducing the dose to a level that produces a tolerable rash may not be such a bad thing after all, because that person may not need so much. And I think that's particularly true in the EGFR mutated tumors, where we think, and all the data shows, that maybe we are overdosing them. We don't know that, but maybe we're overdosing, because in cell lines and in vitro systems, you need very little of these agents to kill those cells. So why you have to produce such a bad rash? However, on the other side, there was all these analysis that showed that people that develop severe rashes do better. And that led to the thinking that dose intensity may be important, or that these are people that actually have a predisposition to develop very bad rashes, and that means that they have a very sensitive immune system. And that, in certain ways, related to prognosis. So we don't know. But what I think is an interesting question that has not been addressed is whether the intensity of rash correlates with outcome in the mutated patients. I don't think anybody's looked at that. And I think we should, because, and I don't know what to predict will be the results there, as we couldn't predict in the past. Some people said, oh, rash means nothing. Others say, well, rash means good survival. And when the analysis was done in a blinded way, well, it turned out that, yes, rash for erlotinib predicted for survival. But in the mutated patients, we don't know. And there is a line of thought that thinks, why you need 150? You may only need 50 or 100, and most of these people will only have grade 1 rashes, and rash becomes then a no entity, because a grade 1 rash really doesn't need much of any attention, you know? But I think that's an interesting thing, whether in the mutated patients also dose intensity is important or not.
What about the special skin cream you've been working on for this problem?
We'll try to develop something that could be given topically that would rescue the skin from the effects of the inhibitor, like leucovorin rescues methotrexate. That was our concept. And what we did is to develop inhibitors of phosphatases. Because at the level of the kinase, there is a phosphatase. And the phosphatase constantly is removing the phosphate and deactivates or inhibits, if you want. So when you inhibit the phosphatase, you theoretically keep the receptor activated, you know. And if the rash is due to inhibition of the receptor in the skin, if you alter that balance between kinase and phosphatase by a phosphatase inhibitor, and it's topical, you theoretically should rescue the skin. And this is being done, and what we did is select one of these agents that had been already put in a cream, which is menadione or vitamin K3. And that's being developed, that was licensed to a company who are developing it and are doing the clinical studies to see whether that actually prevents or is effective in the treatment.
You mentioned the question of adjuvant therapy in the patient with the EGFR mutation-positive tumor. Where are we right now in terms of adjuvant therapy for the rest of the patients? How do you approach it in your own practice?
So I think that, as I saw today an article in JCO, this has been a significant pickup by oncologists in terms of adjuvant therapy for lung cancer. And obviously stage 2 to 3As, it's non-controversial. And in stage 1B, it's this size, the more than 4 centimeters. And less than 4 centimeters, and all the stage 1As, it's basically we tell the patients there's no evidence, therefore we shouldn't do it. In terms of the regimen, the best data, what we're doing, tumor boards, oncologists come and they discuss, they like to argue. And the guy who always says, well, guys, we should give everybody Nalbuphine-cis, probably is right. I mean, most of the data is Nalbuphine-cis. But I guess we have no problem in extrapolating that if Nalbuphine-cis is as good as many other regimens in advanced disease, it should be as good in adjuvant. So we tend to use other regimens in adjuvant. And certainly I like the pemetrexed regimens, particularly in elderly patients, which is a lot of our patients because it's better tolerated. We don't have much data there, and obviously it has to be the adenos, the squamous are excluded. And in a young person, I might use Taxotere-cis because I believe it's probably one of the most effective and also one of the most toxic combinations. But it's a curative situation. As a result of that, as you know, we have agreed that cisplatin is probably what you should use. And in a young person, I use cisplatinum Taxotere because there was that study that proved some superiority compared to cisplatinum Nalbuphine in advanced patients. So this is a curative situation. So again, telling the patient I'm going to give you a very toxic regimen is not a problem to me, because I'm telling them I'm trying to really enhance the chances of curing you.
What about the issue of the older patient? Can you talk a little bit about your overall approach to the older patients? There was a presentation at ASCO, a plenary presentation, obviously, about this, but your own approach to these patients.
Well, I think also I would voice the opinion of many of my colleagues if I say that age is not necessarily the important factor. Because you see patients that are 75, and the spectrum of the level of functioning of these people is amazing. Some people at 75, they look like 60, and there are people 75, they look like 90-year-old. So I think age is probably not something that we consider so seriously. However, when we get to 80 or more, even if the patients look good, we tend to be a little bit more conservative or cautious. But I think it's PS what really drives the whole thing. And what is clear about PS is that, and we see that all the time with our fellows and different physicians, is that it requires a little bit of a good questioning of the patient to really make a nice assessment of the PS. And when I am with the fellows and I say, what do you think is a PS? And then I go, we not all the time agree. If you really look at how many hours they are sitting and in bed and what level of activity and symptoms and this and that. But I think if you do a good assessment of PS, this is probably one of the best prognostic indicators. So in elderly, let's forget about the age. Let's say 80, 81. If PS 0, PS 1, you would try to give combination chemotherapy. And probably a pemetrexed regimen to me is more attractive with carbo, because this is probably the least toxic. And it's really rare to see very bad toxicity with this. Now, when we come to PS 2 and PS 3, obviously the problem starts here. We're dealing with, first of all, a PS 2 is a patient that has a very poor prognosis. The survival is already very short. So you don't necessarily want to be very aggressive. So the study at ASCO in PS2-3 that was placebo against erlotinib, I think, was a great study to do, because we know that erlotinib is a drug that will cause rash and discomfort but will not really have a significant lethal toxicity. And before you send patients for just supportive care or hospice, if we had an opportunity of giving them an oral TKI, that worked, that would be great. And it was done. And unfortunately, the results are extremely modest. Just in the females, there was some advantage. But in the overall population, the study is basically negative, which in a way can be interpreted that giving erlotinib to this patient population with PS2s or 3s frontline doesn't make much of any sense. I mean, you could do it in the females, because the subset in females really looks much better. But in any case, so what to do here in PS2s or 3s, single-agent chemotherapy is probably what has been most popular. And I think giving pemetrexed alone is something I have done. It's well-tolerated. And if they tolerate well and I see response, I may add the carbo later on and see how things go. And probably that's what most people are doing, single-agent chemotherapy for PS2s. Although there's been some studies also showing that combination chemo may actually benefit some of these patients.
I assume in this situation, when you talk about PS2, you're talking about not from PS2 because of the tumor. Is that a different situation if they're
because of the tumor?
In other words, they were doing very well and that their symptomatology is more related to the cancer as opposed to their underlying age and comorbidities.
Correct. No, I think that PS2 is related to the tumor. I mean, it's very difficult to distinguish. I mean, comorbidities is one thing, but PS2, or people that are lying in bed most of the time, that's a manifestation of the tumor. That's a symptom produced by the tumor, like lack of appetite and tiredness and fatigue. Yeah.
What about the older patient who's in PS0 in great shape in terms of the question of Bev?
Yeah, well, I think that I have used bevacizumab in patients that PS0, and again, not thinking that the age is the important thing. But there was the analysis on 4599 suggesting that the benefit of Bev in that patient population is limited or non-existent. But again, it's a subset retrospective analysis. And as you know, the problem we have with these analyses is that sometimes we use them because we like the data, and sometimes we do them, but then we don't like the data, and then we say, well, it's a retrospective analysis. So in general, I try to say that we should probably follow the conclusions of the study based on the endpoint of the design. So I've not necessarily been very convinced that because somebody is 79 but in great shape, you shouldn't use bevacizumab. Although, yeah, we have the retrospective analysis that showed there was no benefit.
How do you approach the issue of using bevacizumab and, for that matter, cetuximab in first-line therapy of metastatic non-small cell?
I use bevacizumab regularly as frontline therapy, and I have used it at least with the regimen, the American regimen, carboplatin-paclitaxel. And the reason for that is because GEMCIS in the AVAIL study gave results that were not so robust. But the question has come, obviously, all the time that carboplatin-paclitaxel may not be the best regimen for adenocarcinoma. As the Pemetrexed study showed, when they compared to GemCis. So I also believe that probably the best regimen for adenocarcinoma is probably PEM platinum. So then we are left here with this dilemma. I have here this patient who is telling me, doctor, I understand you guys are doing randomized studies and you go by the results, but I have no time to wait for the results of the next randomized study. I want you and me to make a decision of what you believe is a reasonable risk to take, making some reasonable predictions of what you believe will be the next level. And then comes this fun situation. We say, well, we treat this disease by giving chemo and then by adding some of the other agents. And we believe that for adenocarcinoma, which is what you have, probably PEM platinum is the regimen. A little better, nothing spectacular, and well tolerated. And then if we have to add something in addition for adenocarcinoma, well, bevacizumab is the number one. So if you want me to give you the recipe that is not demonstrated with solid data, but that has a very high probability of showing that it is a regimen, would be a pemetrexed and platinum bevacizumab. And I think patients that are educated and they understand what they have and how to interpret data are going to go for it because they will realize that most likely that regimen will not be inferior to carboplatin-paclitaxel bevacizumab. It might, but most likely will not be. So we all have done that. But I think it requires explanation to the patient and make the patient understand that if he goes for second or third opinion, he's going to hear things like, this doctor is doing things that have not been demonstrated. Because at least in the environment we are in the Northeast, I mean, it's very, very common that patients will look for second and third opinion. So it's important when you see a patient that you explain to him that there are many ways of thinking, and there are different probabilities, and not necessarily there's one right and the others are wrong. Because when they go to see somebody else, you know, they have to understand that there is a certain amount of controversy in all these things. And by making them participants, I think that helps. So to answer the question, in general, I would use it with carboplatin-paclitaxel. If patients can understand what we're trying to do, I will discuss the possibility of using it with an pemetrexed regimen. And personally, I believe inside myself that there is a high probability that that regimen will be the regimen, although obviously the data is not there yet.
How do you approach the issue of maintenance therapy, particularly in those patients who are getting, for example, carboplatin-paclitaxel Bev or carbo-PEM-Bev?
Okay, so we normally give Bev as maintenance because it makes biological sense, although there was never a study that compared maintenance versus no maintenance. So we are stuck on that one, but it makes biological sense. And if it is reimbursed and the patients don't have to pay out of pocket like happens in many other countries, then at least the financial burden for the patient is out of the picture. Now, what to do in terms of introducing another agent for maintenance? And I guess the question is pemetrexed or erlotinib, which are the two agents now approved for that. Well, I think we all have seen this data and we all believe that it's positive data. But what does that mean exactly? And I think what it means exactly is that the results of the maintenance trials are positive because in reality, many patients in the control arms never get any further therapy. So in other words, the people that get maintenance get more therapy than the others. So it represents a real-world situation because the control arm is really standard of care, it's observation. But it's not necessarily because somebody receives maintenance that he's going to live longer. It is because probably many of the people who don't receive maintenance will never receive anything else because they get lost, they develop bone mets, spinal cord compression, whatever, and they never get anything else. So The way I approach this, and some of my colleagues approach it differently, is that if I see a patient that I believe is at high risk of never coming back or showing up, or is non-compliant, or is, you can see, is the classical person who having to wait 2 days for the results of PET CT is a very stressful situation. You see that this individual is probably going to give up earlier than others and be lost. And if in addition, I believe that that individual could have an EGFR mutation, for example, he was relatively very light smoker years ago, and I cannot test it. So if I have just, listen, this guy might have the mutation, you'll never know. And this guy is non-compliant, you may lose him. And the worst thing I think that one oncologist, thoracic oncologist, will want to know today is that one of your patients died of the disease, had an EGFR mutation, and you never gave him the EGFR TKI. So that's why if I have the suspicion that this individual can have it or has a high probability, and I may never be able to give it to him, I might start him on erlotinib maintenance. And that will be the situation. Or if no, he's a very heavy smoker, but I know I'm going to lose him, I may give him pemetrexed. But I think it's an option, and most of the thoracic oncologists will not give it as a rule. You know, it's something that we consider on a patient-per-patient basis, but it's an option.
We were talking about EGFR TKIs. What about the so-called irreversible EGFR TKIs? There was a presentation at ASCO on BIBW2992. Yeah. What do we know about that and similar agents?
Well, this seems to be like the next generation, because at the end of the day, erlotinib is reversible, which means that it blocks, but as soon as the drug disappears from the cell, ATP takes over. So the idea of having something that will bind to that site and prevent ATP from coming in for a prolonged period of time, I think obviously is important and has implications in terms of dosage. Maybe you don't need to dose every day anymore, and it might be a more effective way of inhibiting. So I think it makes sense to develop agents that do the same thing as erlotinib and gefitinib, but they do it in a different way because that gives us a chance of getting a better agent. And I think this represents an opportunity. And the data so far on this agent and other agents support the concept that probably, or there's a chance these agents are superior to the first generation agents, although still we don't have the results. So the comparative studies are going on. But it makes sense to block that target in an irreversible way, and the impact would be on a better inhibition, and second, on a not necessarily a need for daily administration.
What about small cell? Anything new in the last year or so in terms of that disease?
Well, you know, the small cell is always that part of lung cancer where paradoxically there's very little going on. And the most exciting thing in the last few years has been amrubicin. Amrubicin is an anthracycline, so it's basically an analog of doxorubicin. But if you look at the molecule and you understand how these compounds work, certainly it behaves differently in the cell. I think it's deaminated. It has some important changes. I mean, people that understand the chemistry of these compounds know that a compound like that will not react with DNA the same way. So Japanese did some good studies with small cell, and we all were obviously very, very skeptical. But then I think Ettinger and others have done in the country studies with amrubicin, and it shows that probably superior to topotecan for second line. And I know there are now definitive studies going on. I would think that, and I know quite well this field of the anthracyclines from my early years as a researcher, I think there's a decent chance that actually this compound will be better than topotecan. And we have heard very high response rates compared to topo, because we need something small cell. And then there's all the molecular things. BCL2 has been a target for a small cell because 90% of them have overexpression of BCL2. And the antisense approach is being tested. So that's a reasonable target. The hedgehog inhibitors are being now studied. So there is some activity, but nothing as clear as the EGFR mutations in non-small cell. But again, we discovered that after we got the drug. So maybe we'll have to have a reasonable drug and then try to figure out how it works.